I'm Dhiren Garrahy and you're listening to The Laughs of Your Life, the podcast where I talk to influential people about laughter, from their first memories of laughter to feeling laughed at to their no laughing matter moments in life.
I think when the lockdown happened initially, there was that huge thing about get your paintbrushes out and be creative and everything. And I never heard so much bollocks in my life. You know, I really thought it was putting pressure on people when you're in the least creative time in your life, because it was very uncertain. And, you know, they needed a kind of a cooling down period to go, what the hell is happening here? Because none of us knew.
Comedian, actor, and all-round entertainer Pat Short is my guest this week. He talks to me about losing count of his siblings, the madness of the unbelievable days, and how, unsurprisingly, he's not a last laugh kind of guy. From big laughs to big wins, this season of the Laughs of Your Life podcast is brought to you by TK Maxx, big name brands without breaking the bank. The weekend just gone, I had a very chilled weekend because ever since things have opened up a bit more, I've been making plans and meeting friends and doing this, that and the other. But the weekend just gone, I had no plans except to do a bit of homeware shopping. You know when you have a holiday to look forward to and all you can focus on is a holiday? Then the holiday's over and you're back in your living space and you need a bit of oomph pumped into it. So I went up to TK Maxx to their homeware section. I got the most gorgeous candles. I got two new cushions. And just as I was about to nip to the till, in true TK Maxx style, I spotted the most gorgeous parka, which is perfect for my autumn winter wardrobe, which I am very much focusing on at the moment. And all of that came to a price you'd expect to pay for just the parka, because that's what TK Maxx is known for. That's why we love it. So if you need some autumnal fashion or seasonal homeware or beauty bits, nip into TK Maxx ASAP. I highly recommend. As we always say, big wins, small prices at TK Maxx. And now for my chat with Pat Short. I hope you enjoy. Pat Short, you are extremely welcome to the Laughs of Your Life.
Thank you very much, Dhiren. Good to see you.
Oh my God. I 7 or 8 year old me is pinching herself, wondering what the hell did I do in life where I've got to the point where I'm just having the chats with Pat Short.
Stop. You're embarrassing me now.
No, I honestly don't mean to do that. And I try not to do it too much. I try not to fangirl. But look, I'm sure we'll get to it throughout the conversation. I'm not the one in the hot seat, but I feel like I want to start with my first memories of laughter, because just before we start, because I just want to get this out. Oh my God. My first memories of laughter, Pat, right?
Yes.
I swear on my life, my first memory, we had a little sitting room, you know, like a small sitting room where the toys would be everywhere and you'd have a TV in the corner and you'd have whatever, the couch. And my parents were both Clare, but we were born and reared in Dublin.
Okay.
So we, but Clare was so much part of us, and just like country tropes were so much part of us. And my very first memory of laughter, you know, when you're a kid, you don't really, you often tend to sit on the floor before you'll sit on the couch. You just kind of chill out. My first memory of laughter is sitting on the floor in our sitting room. And my dad has this thing where he can't just laugh. Actually, a bit like you, you know, you have a big laugh and then laugh. My dad has one of those laughs where he can't just laugh like this. He has to like spread his legs and like bend over. And my first memory of laughter is watching Crime Busters with my dad, like almost choking laughing. And like, what, it was either Crime, but it was Crime Busters, but then it was the weather and then it was the robbery in the shop. And I remember being like, this is what dad, and you know, you idolize your dad at that age.
Of course.
Is what dad finds funny. This is what's funny.
I
then became hooked. And so anyway, I'm making this all about me. I just wanted to get it out. I was bursting to tell you.
Listen, get into the questions.
Sorry.
You're embarrassing me now.
No, you're too humble, Pat. Okay. Pat Short.
Yes.
Your first memory of laughter.
That's a tough one. I suppose we used to always be laughing around the kitchen table. You know, it's that, we had a big house, like 11 or 12 kids. But if you're to talk about comedy, I think Buster Keaton and Harold Lloyd, because RTÉ used to play that in the afternoon. I don't know, was it the summertime or whatever, the old black and white. And my grandfather was a big fan of Buster Keaton. So he's, when we were like kids, like what you're saying there, he used to sit us down in front of Buster Keaton and Harold Lloyd, and he'd be explaining and he'd be roaring laughing. And of course, we idolized our grandfather as well, you know. So we were roaring after that. I think after that, Halsby Turn Weekly was the next one then. Yeah. Maya and Cha and all that. And to get to work with some of them afterwards, like, you know, was a real amazing experience. You know, and Father Ted. And I got to work, I thought Eamon Morrissey was amazing. I still do think he's amazing. And I got to work with him on a BBC sitcom called The Fits back in 2000. That was just to be working in the same studio with that man after growing up watching him on Hospital Weekly was amazing, you know. So I think that was the first kind of, and my first kind of adultish kind of experience to comedy was on a video back in the days when videos were shown videos. And I remember seeing Billy Connolly on one of his videos and just being absolutely blown away, because I'd never seen, you see, we grew up in the countryside where RT1 and 2, we only had RT1 actually, we didn't even have RT2. And that was all you had, you know? So, and then the video culture came along. And I do remember my first ever comic video was watching in a pub, Billy Connolly, and it was one with bananas on, he'd big banana feet or something like that. I can't remember what the video was. But he's the craft of storytelling, and he's had stories and just hilarious in his songs. He was incredible. But that was, they were kind of my very early days of it.
Talk to me about laughter in your household when you were younger, when you were a child.
Oh God. I suppose
first of all, where did you come in the sibling ranking?
There was four, was there many? There was You'd think I'd know it at this stage, wouldn't you? I think there was eight older than me and four or five younger than me, or something like that. One, three, four younger than me. And so I was five from the bottom. It sounds like
nine from the top.
It sounds like a Sesame Street song, doesn't it? You know, I'm not at the bottom, but sure. Sitting on the stairs. I used to love that. Anyway, I was kind of at the bottom, the younger crew. And when you have a family that size, you do kind of break into groups, you know, because there is an older group and there's a younger group, and they've just moved on, you know, the older group of brothers and sisters. So there's about four of us used to hang out together.
My dad is one of 11, and it's funny, he says the same thing. Like, yeah. he's third from the bottom. and even their memories, I think I've said this on podcasts before, and I've talked to people about big families, big Irish families, even their memories of childhood, like, are just so different. Like, yeah. the older kids, because they had to help. They had to almost rear the younger half of the family. Like, would that have been the case? Like, when you reflect with your siblings, do you kind of go, I don't really remember it being like that?
Well, if yes and no, in a sense, you're right. The older ones look at, and in my case, my mother died when we were all very young. So the older ones definitely looked after the younger ones. And there was a very big bond between all of us. There was a big bond between the whole lot of us, but definitely the generation gap of some of them grew up in the 70s, kind of. We were late 70s, early 80s. But the others were early 70s. So their memories of even the town and growing up and people around and everything was very different.
When did performance come into your life?
I think at a very young age. My dad is a great musician, and I believe my mother played piano. So there was music was very important in the house. And my old brothers and sisters and all everyone played music. But I joined the brass band when I was probably 9 years of age. So that involved going on every Sunday, it'd be marching some town or other, and Paddy's Day parades were big. I played 1979. I played in every Paddy's Day parade in the country, even Dublin, when I was young. But I played in Chicago when I was 1979, and I was 12 at the time. And we spent a fortnight over there playing gigs and stuff. So you were going around playing these gigs, and they were really gigs and performances, you know, with the band from a young age. And then I went on playing music in my teens then, as you do with a, you know, local blues band or whatever, a bunch of Leophilus. And then when I went to college in Limerick, I started playing with John. I met up with John, and we used to do a residency every Wednesday night where John was already very well established. And I was only a student, so I started playing with him Wednesday nights, and we'd kind of mess around and have a bit of crack with it. And that developed into what everybody knows as the Unbelievers down the line. So I would always kind of say the brass band as a young fella, I was performing even though I didn't think about it.
Yeah.
But it was different. When I started working with John, I really was very shy about stage work and acting. I'm doing a lot of work with my daughter at the moment. And she's been to college and trained, and it's amazing. She just eats it up and loves it. And I didn't have that confidence when I was her age, because I hadn't studied it and I didn't understand it fully. And I was still kind of finding my feet on stage. So the real performance didn't really start till I was about 2 or 3 years into it with John. And I started kind of getting more confident and having the crack, you know.
Would you say that actually, naturally, you're an introvert?
Yeah, I would. Even like the nature of our, like, you know what it's like, Darren. You know, you're forced out into the public eye. People expect you to be funny, expect you to be a performer, expect you to be full of life. When I'm with my very close friends, I am full of life. But when I'm touring, for example, and I'm on my own in a hotel or somewhere like that, I'm much happier to stay in my room or bury in a book or something, and not kind of just randomly go up to people and go, well, how are you getting on? What's the weather like? And who's playing the match? You know, I don't do any of that. I'd stay a million miles away from people. Because, I mean, I don't know, maybe I'm just around people a lot. And I like my own space.
And that can be tough as well, because, you know, there is that little tiny bit of guilt. I actually spoke to Marty Morrissey about this before, because he is one of those characters who people, you know, they might only ever see Marty Morrissey once in their lives, and they're expecting him to go,
hi, Marty, Marty.
He's expecting them to be like, are you coming to the nightclub with me tonight? And he, like, he mightn't necessarily be in the form to do that, but then there's the little hint of, oh God, like, it's the only time they'll ever meet me, and I need, you know, like, does that creep in ever?
Yeah, it does. I mean, I have gone up to people myself, you know, and said, hello, how are you? I'd like to get a photograph with you.
Yes, yeah.
You know, and I know what it's like to get the courage up to ask someone.
Yes.
The last thing you want is someone to turn around and go, fuck off. You know what I mean? Sorry, I'm busy or something. I'm very conscious that anyone that asks me for a photograph or sign something, they've probably debated it for about 5 minutes before they come near you. And, you know, it takes a lot. So you don't hurt someone's feelings. So I'm always glad to make the effort with people. Because I know what it's like. I did one of my favorite films is Old Boy. It's the Korean movie. And I was at the film festival in Busan in South Korea. And to kind of entertain me and the other Irish that were there for the night, they had the lead actor from Old Boy come in to hang out with us in a small bar, about 20 of us. And so I had to go up and get a photograph. And I felt like an idiot. But it was actually, I did. Do you know what? I didn't go up and ask him for a photograph until I was locked later that night. I was with my driver and interpreter, and I was getting into a car, and I spotted him and went, fucker, here I go. And I ran up to he had a lot of bodyguards around him and everything. And he was very nice. He was very nice, but he's an amazing actor. Amazing.
Oh my God. Okay. Pat Short, the first time you felt laughed at?
Oh, in a good way or a bad way?
Whatever way you want to take it. Do you know what? I'd say in a bad way is probably a better story.
My daughter. When she wanted to get at me, when she was like 13, you know, she'd say, Dad, you know, people are laughing at you. They're not laughing with you.
Stop!
Oh, I'd say to her, at least they're paying to laugh at me.
Oh my God, I love it. Mic drop.
Yeah, we used to be roaring laughing at it. You know, she does her way of digging at me, you know, and make me feel bad. So when did the first time people laughed? Do you know one of the first times I realised I was doing, and I didn't know what I was doing, but it was kind of a funny one. When myself and John started doing sketches together, he's desperate. He used to land me on stage beside him, and I'd know what the fuck I'm meant to do here. And he'd be off doing this really funny routine. I didn't know what to do, so I used to just stand there smiling. And funny, like, it would build over time, and people would be looking at me, and I just didn't know what to do, so I used to just stand there smiling. And gradually, it got infectious, and the whole audience was roaring laughing at me for doing nothing. And we Seth and John realised it after, so we made it part of the act. When the show would open, John would say, look, I gotta go. I fucking left my freaking radio mic thing or something. I'll be back in 2 minutes. Just keep it going. So I just stand there. And I remember someone saying to me, that's a really brave thing to do as an actor, to stand there and do
yeah.
that. And I used to go, I didn't know what to do. So yeah. I wasn't really performing. I was shitting myself.
People are like, I really like your method there, the way you live in the silence.
And I'm funny, a lot of things with me comedy-wise kind of grew out of kind of awkwardness and things like that. Not yeah. what to do, you know. So you kind of acted, you know, you just found these moments and you held on to them then.
So much of the unbelievable stuff is just observational, everyday comedy. And I think, like, it's probably very obvious to say this, but that is what connected with, that's what people connected with. They know the person in their local pub who talks exactly the way one of the characters would say, Crime Busters or The Weather or whatever it might be. Like, did you know how big it would become simply from the observational way you did it?
No, we were the classic, you know, overnight success after about 5 or 7 years. You know what I mean? you know, when we were doing shows in like the Bale Bucked in Dublin with 14 people coming to see us and that kind of stuff. And it was the same material, not material, but same style of show in the sense of observation. And I think, like any comedy, you do what you think is funny. That's all you can do. You can't. You know, I'm never going to write comedy to make Dirren laugh. I will write it to make me laugh. And if you laugh with it, it's brilliant. Yeah. And that's, now we're winning. You know what I mean? And that's all you can do. So we used to find it very funny, you know, going along to GA things. And I remember we did, this is the kind of thing we used to do in the early days that kind of influenced a bit. We were asked to do, I won't mention the area, but giving out the medals to the under 16 team. And it was a big night. They won the county final. And there was a kind of a celebration night in a local bar in County Limerick. So we were asked to do the entertainment. So we went along thinking we're doing comedy, only to realize all they wanted was jiving. So I had an accordion and John could sing a few songs, and we were on a kind of, we were standing on the seats. We were even pushed back from the corner. There were so many people there, and we were playing for hours. Like, it was just, it went on and on and on. And eventually a fella grabbed the mic and he was as rough as be Jesus. And he says, will the fucking women go into the fucking kitchen and get the sandwiches and bring them out? And this is 12 o'clock at night. And the young fellas, will you start lining up for your medals? And the band are going to play on for another 2 hours. Now, come on, to fuck. We were like, what? We've been going since about 8 o'clock. We said, 2 more hours of this shit. And your man was as rough. And he kind of, this character that I'm talking about, kind of was the backbone to John's character as the GA character. He was just as rough as Jesus, with no filter on him whatsoever. And, you know, it was all about him and the whole team. And the way the mannerisms with him and everything, and the language was just atrocious. Like, he couldn't say one sentence without maybe five fucks inside it. You know what I mean?
Inside it?
Yeah. It was nuts. Like, it was just... And he was hilarious. Like, he was absolutely hilarious and an iconic GA character. But he also kind of epitomized a lot of characters like that. So we saw, like, we used to see these things, and obviously being an actor, whatever, a comedian, whatever you want to call yourself, you use stagecraft then to make it, to put it on stage. You know, you couldn't just take the character. You'd have to, you know, create it. And then came the big hands and the hat to exaggerate all his movements and all that kind of stuff. And it was very funny, but the reason it was a really funny piece was it was funny anyway, but there was a sense of reality that people understood. They knew these characters. You know, this character was real. And we were just reflecting that in a comic way. And that was the kind of way with the teacher character, with the priest characters to do, you know, all these different characters. They were an element of, like, the priest character was not one, the teacher character was not one character that I experienced. It was a couple of teachers mixed into one.
Yeah.
But they all had a similar kind of trait, you know. and they still exist, you know. My daughter was telling me recently, she went to a school. She was only telling me the other day that they had, guy used to come in and give him a pep talk before the leaving cert. You know, the school would bring him in. And he gave him a speech. And she said, all we wanted to do was to get our heads in the books for the last hour before the fucking exams. Yeah, yeah. But your man came in and gave the dressing room speech inside in the classroom. And she said it was a kind of a school that was lots of foreign nationals, like Chinese people and that. And she said, I got it because I knew the family were GA. But the Chinese people, what were they thinking this fellow was all about? And apparently he gave the same speech every year to every six. So it's not, it hasn't gone away. You know what I mean? It's still there.
Yeah. Okay, Pat, the moment when if you didn't laugh, you'd cry.
If you didn't laugh, you cried. Do you know what? I don't ever remember anything like that. In the sense, Darren, that my default is laugh.
Yeah.
Even when it's not, shouldn't be laughing. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I've gotten myself into trouble at funerals and places like that because.
Well, that's perfect. That's what I mean.
Yeah.
So using it as a coping mechanism.
Well, I remember my grand-aunt's funeral, and it was a very sad affair, obviously, you know, and it was blah. But in the turlis where she was laid out, I'll never forget because my family in the front, you know when you kind of people come into this mass, not before mass, before they go to the church,
yes.
And people shake hands and all that malarkey. And so she was in the coffin, poor old Molly, and this old one came in that none of us recognised, went up and kissed the corpse, and then nestled into the front between everybody. And she turned around to my stepmother and said, "He went very grey in the last few days."
Oh, God.
And I was behind, I could hear this. I had to go, "That's Molly Bradshaw." And what? It's a completely wrong funeral. She wasn't due for another hour. Some old fella. She kissed the corpse and everything. It was a real country thing. I just thought, oh my God.
And did she get up and go?
Yeah.
That is gold. And would that grand aunt, would that have been your mom's sister or your dad's sister?
It would have been my grandmother's sister.
Oh, sorry, your grandmother's.
Yeah.
Oh, no, the reason
on my
I
mother's,
ask...
On my mother's side, sorry.
Yes. No, the reason I ask is because I had been doing my research and I hadn't realised that you were so young when you'd lost your mum. You were seven. Was it seven?
Yeah. And funny you mentioned aunts. Both my parents were only children. So I've no uncles, aunts or first cousins.
Wow.
So it's really weird in that sense, growing up without any extended family. Like, second cousin is my closest relation. And I have very few of them because they're a lot older. That'd be my mother's first cousin is my closest relation.
And do you remember, I remember I spoke to Donegal O'Callaghan, he was on the podcast, and he lost his dad when he was six. And he said his first memory was, he used to hop into the bed between his parents. And he said the night that his dad had died, he got in and it was cold. And he said that's all he remembers.
Wow. Yeah.
You know? And so what was it like for you? And I suppose, look at this comfort in having so many siblings, and maybe that was a great thing.
Actually, it was very confusing, Darren, in the sense that you had no concept of it at that age. And you notice lots of people upset around you, and you fully didn't grasp what was going on. I'd only get it for a few years afterwards. Do you know what I mean? It wasn't upsetting. I'm not saying it like that. It was more confusing. And you're trying to understand what in the name of God is going on. Because look, my mother had been sick for a long time prior to it. She died of cancer. So she would have been, and she came home to die, you know, that kind of situation.
Yeah.
So she was out of the house for, gosh, the bones of months beforehand. And that's a big time in a small person's age, you know. So I kind of don't have much memory of her in that respect, you know, of spending time and doing things with her and all that kind of stuff. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it is kind of, as I say, it wasn't upsetting. It was confusing. And the sense of loss didn't come years later, I think, you know.
Okay. Okay. Your no laughing matter moment in life, Pat. So the moment where there was no room for laughter, and I know you say you laugh your way out of things, but you can't get out of this one now. When was there no room for laughter for you?
Oh God.
You're not allowed to laugh.
I don't, you have me on that. No. Like, I mean, God, I really, you know, I get myself in so much trouble for laughing.
A moment where shit hit the fan in your life.
When the PA broke down during the gigs, 1,000 people asked us.
No! Stop.
and it never came back on, and I had to finish the show running through the audience. I'll never forget, that was scary as hell.
Where was that?
I can't. I'm not going to go into it. I don't want to.
Oh God! You don't want
to. I will talk to you someday about it when I'm able to talk about it. It's just those awful moments. You know, like we've all done the corporate gigs as well, where you're standing in front of. But I remember we did one. This is years back, myself and John. And you know, you have 40 minutes in a corporate gig. That's kind of like the standard. You know what I mean? You never do an hour or whatever. So we went and did the gig. And which was in, I remember it was out in a hotel, was it Malahide or somewhere like that? Or anyway. And we suddenly realized the gig, we were expecting a ballroom or something. No, it was only, I think it was 14 fellas at a table.
No.
And we had to go to the end of the table and do the show. And they're all Swedish or something. Their English was good, but like Ireland, Irish character.
Stop.
So like we've 40 minutes to do, you know, you're kind of thinking in your head, if I don't do this, I'm not going to get paid or whatever. It's we rattled through the 40 minutes and we came off the two. It was shell shocked. You know, absolutely nobody laughing, playing a few songs, doing a few things, and they're looking like they just want to get up and have a fag or something. You know what I mean? We were kind of holding them back from it, but we've 40 minutes to do, so we kept going. And we came off, went to the promoters, was that all right? Was it all right? It's fucking brilliant. Said Neil Tobin did it last year, he lasted 10 minutes. Derek Morgan did 15. He went through the list every year to get a comedian. And every year it's a fucking nightmare for the comedian. And not one person ever finished the 40 minutes. We were the only to do it. Because we thought, everyone's getting paid anyway. So, we could have walked off after 15, and I think they probably would have preferred it. But it was hilarious. It was so funny. But that wasn't funny.
Moments like that can maybe change your mind or make you think about taking another direction. Like you've had such a long and colourful career in performing overall, because it hasn't just been stage, it's been screen, it's been everything, it's been music. Have you ever had a moment where you've gone, A, why did I ever do any of this? Or B, will I take another direction? And if so, what would you have done?
I couldn't do anything because I just didn't have any skills. I left school and went to college and did a year in our college. And I was doing an interview with some students recently, and it was so funny. They kind of said, you know, you took a big risk. You left college and went off to become a comedian. And I kind of thought to myself, I gave up painting pictures to become a comedian. That was a big risk, all right. I mean, I had a career ahead of me painting landscapes. It's like the Kerry jazz man, you know, he was only in it for the money. You know that old joke? I felt it was a bit like that. So, there was moments when I was like that moment at corporate gig. Another one on Channel 5 in London when we went to do an interview and the producer had seen our video and thought it'd be amazing. It was brilliant. The openings, that opening video where John came in and I turned him home to get out to the car park and wanted to. So we didn't have any costumes around, and it was Channel 5 had just launched that week and Sony asked us to do the interview. So we went in and the producer said, no, that's the funniest thing I've seen. We said, we don't have costumes. We didn't come for that. And he says, couldn't you do it as a floor manager? And John, you come in with a guitar and you tell him to get off. So we thought, oh, Jesus. And he was going, please do it. It's going to be hilarious. So we said, it's not the characters. Okay, we'll do it.
Yeah.
Of course, John comes in the middle of the show, it's kind of an interruption thing. I stop him and say, sorry, what are you doing? Sorry, and then the floor manager's headset on. The audience thought it was for real.
No!
There was nobody laughing at all. We went through the whole routine. And you know what, like a minute of television, this felt like a minute. This was like 3 minutes, felt like 4 hours of television.
Torture.
And they're all London as well, you know, so... And there was a panel of five in the TV. So I remember your man came out and said, hey, this is unbelievable. The contemporary modern Irish comedy.
Oh, God. Oh, God. Oh,
in other words, it's not funny. It's just...
Yeah, apologies.
Oh, it was all wrong. Like, we were just out of our characters and we should never have done it. And that was a moment I really felt, oh my God, this is just horrific, you know.
But it was a lesson in I suppose, sticking to your guns and not letting people try and change what you do. And is that something you've learned throughout your career as well?
That's... Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I never, especially when you play characters and stuff, people will constantly, you know, the one thing I get when I do interviews on a lot of radio stations and stuff, and I'm sure you probably get it if local radios and places. So, look, we're going to do an interview, and just as the interview starts, look, do you want to do it in character? And you're going, do you realize how hard it is to create gags and scenarios? You know, you can jump into a character, but when you jump into a character, you're normally taking a segment from a show you've done or something that's scripted. But to turn around and do a half-hour interview totally in characters, like, are you joking me? You're mad. Whereas before, I would have thought, oh shit, I better do it. And we would have tore into a character thing and gone mental, you know, and that always turns to shit anyway. I really did learn from a couple of instances of that to stick to your guns, don't do it, you know, because it'll just turn into a disaster and it'll be dreadful.
Yeah. No, it's an important one.
Yeah.
Okay. Pat, the person you always laugh with.
Look, I think we all have our friends. I have a couple of very close friends of mine. I go fishing with and hang out with, and we go away together. I hop in a van and drive down to Portugal and stuff like that. We used to when it was possible. And yeah, he's a very good friend of mine. I won't mention names to embarrass him, although I should. he'd be the guy that I constantly, we'd sit out the back in the house here, or I'd sit over in his place, and we just laugh constantly. Like, you'd be tears falling down your face, you know, just over stupid things. And I think we know each other long enough. It's like, you know, I don't know, it's like a best friend or something. You kind of know each other and have the crack.
Yeah.
And my kids too, I have lots of fun with them too, you know.
Speaking of not being able to go anywhere, how have you found the past year or so? Have you been, because I know, you know, anyone in your industry, I think it's kind of gone one of two ways. Either people are getting extra creative and they're finding the time, you know, this time to be inspiring. And then other people are like, which actually I think more people are like, feck that. I don't feel one bit inspired.
I agree. Yeah. Yeah. No, look, I've been very lucky. I was in the middle of a shoot when this happened. So we were nearly finished it. So we had a couple of weeks to go back to it. So I ended up kind of in August last year finishing that. That's Frank of Ireland, which is coming out this week. I'm not sure when this podcast will be broadcast, but it'll be out over a period. And I was lucky to be able to go do a bit of work. I think when the lockdown happened initially, there was that huge thing about get your paintbrushes out and be creative and everything. And I never heard so much bollocks in my life. You know, I really thought it was putting pressure on people when you're in the least creative time in your life, because it was very uncertain. And, you know, they needed a kind of a cooling down period to go, what the hell is happening here? Because none of us knew. I don't think we know much better, but at least we've been in it a year now. And you've been, I really feel I'm only starting to get very creative in the last couple of months, you know, since Christmas. Really, the first part of the year was really hard. And I'm kind of doing a lot now with Seth and Faye, my daughter. We're doing a lot together and we're having so much fun doing it. And it's gearing us up for a show, live show next year, and a few other things.
Brilliant.
And a TV show. And we're doing it, you know, we've a lot going on there. We did a film last week, a short film up in Galway. So we're looking in, we're essential workers, Darren. I'm not sure if you're as comedians. We are actually, we're in the broadcasting thing. So I'm lucky I can travel, you know, to work, obviously, not to throw myself on a beach.
And generally, how are you with downtime? Are you someone who's good at kind of chilling out, or say if you are in a creative flow, are you kind of bad at stopping and putting down in tools and knowing when to take a break?
I've gotten better at it. And I think, like, the lockdown, because you have to discipline yourself when there is no end game. There is no deadline. So what I've been trying to do is work Monday to Friday like a normal person, which has never happened in my life before, because we tend to gig at weekends and social nights when people are going out. That's our work period. And you kind of work the week around it, which can be hard because then you're in the office and you don't find downtime. So this is good. I kind of take the weekends off. We try to put up a sketch a week, which forces us at the beginning of the week to write, collaborate, put our heads together, and then try and edit and write it and shoot it and edit it by Wednesday, Thursday. And then by Friday, we're off, you know, so take the weekend off, which is rare, and I'm enjoying it. I love cooking. That's a big thing of mine. And I find the lockdown great because there's no restaurants open and stuff. And I try to stop myself from ordering food in. you know what I mean? So it's, you know, because I want to try and eat healthily. And I know you can do that as well when there's great restaurants.
Are you allowed a curry cheese chip every now and then?
I do, but I like cooking. And as a result, I've kind of, you know, I kind of jumped myself into that. And I'm enjoying that as well.
Okay, Pat, a time where you had the last laugh. I feel you're probably going to say you're not a last laugh kind of person, but I'm going to push you for an answer.
Oh my God. Get the last laugh on someone.
Yeah. Or something, even just on life, you know?
Okay. Okay. Gosh, that's a good question. I wouldn't, you're right. I'm going to say I wouldn't be a last laugh type of person. I don't take revenge or go down that route where you kind of go stuff it, even though there's times you feel you should, but it's not in my nature.
Yeah.
Last laugh at life. I've been lucky. I mean, I haven't had illness or anything like that where in my life where I would have to say I bet something or I got over something and had the last laugh in that respect. And that's the only way I can kind of think of it. So I would have to say in that respect, I'm kind of lucky. I don't know. I don't know. It's one I'm going to pass on, Darren, if you don't mind.
Okay. Well, I'm going to push you because in this industry, there can often be maybe opportunities that come your way and you think, okay, this is going to happen for me. I'm going to get this part or, you know, whatever it might be. And it doesn't happen, but then something better happens. Have you ever felt that that's, you know, it's worked in your favor that way, where maybe you were set on something, it didn't go your way, but actually long term, it was probably better that it didn't.
Yeah, I suppose I have auditioned for stuff which I haven't got. And with various different, for various reasons. Do you know what? Some of the stuff I just wasn't suited for. And there's other stuff I really would give my right to get. And I didn't get it, but then got it bigger. Ended up on Broadway, West End. Do you know what I mean? And that's the top in that career, in that world. I didn't get, when I was there, the Tony Awards were floating around. I didn't get nominated for a Tony. But the New York Times said I should have been nominated. And that's, in theatre world, as good as a nomination.
Well, there you go.
So that's what they say in New York. If the New York Times comes out on the nomination, when the nominations are announced, and they have an article where they say who wasn't nominated, who should have been nominated, and who was nominated. And they're the three. And if they say you weren't nominated, that's as good as say you should have been, or if you should have been nominated. It's something like that. And it's the top critic in the Times. And that to me was a really nice one. You know, I didn't realize it until the producers and everyone had said, "Did you see the paper short?" And I like, "No," said you. They said you should have been nominated. That's a New York Times nod of approval, which was cool. I don't like talking about those things too much.
Because, no, Pat, you know, I knew you had a last laugh in you. did you love, how did you feel about being in New York? Would you have been bitten by the bug to stay there?
Well, yeah, I mean, I love New York, but strange enough, I wouldn't, not this time around. And I'll tell you why. I worked in New York for years with John, as John Believers, and we spent often 9 months in America touring over there. It's 3 or 4 months in New York and then maybe across Midwest and a few months in different theatres. And I really loved it in my early 20s. And when I was over there with The Cripple back in 2014 or 15 or 16, around there, I just felt it was almost a younger person's city or something. It was more college orientated.
Yeah.
And in my 20s, I was slap in the middle of that and loving it. I'm now 50 and I'm liking a different aspect of New York, but I kind of missed the madness of my 20s over there. And I was expecting that and it wasn't that. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. You felt old, basically, Pat, is what you
said. Yeah, thank you, Darren. Yeah.
Okay, Pat, if laughter wasn't the best medicine, what would be?
If laughter, well, for me, I would have to say music, because I'm a musician as well, especially traditional Irish music. I absolutely love it. I don't know ever when I've been in a session, even if the musicians aren't great, you know, which we've all been at those ones, haven't we? Yeah. And it's still like, if you hear really good traditional musicians, oh my God, there's nothing like it. You're just taking it. That's the one thing I really miss about this lockdown, going to a session. I really do. I have some very good friends who are just the most amazing musicians, traditional musicians. The rhythm and the pace of it and everything, it's just, there's nothing like it in the world, you know. My dad used to play in a place called the Monks and Turles. It's a famous traditional Irish, Gorman's, a traditional Irish bar. And he started the session there, wow, 30, 40 years ago. Must be 30 years ago. And it was like, they've got amazing musicians there, great musicians. They come from all over to play there. But the last time I was down there to see a session, there was a whole raft of younger musicians and a lot of them playing on Riverdance and Lord of Dance and doing all that kind of stuff. And they're just, I mean, the old guys are brilliant. They're great. They have great character and their music is amazing. But the younger crew were just, the pace and the tunes and everything was just amazing. Amazing, amazing, amazing.
We'll get there, Pat. We'll get there.
We will.
Okay. The actor, this is your quick fire round, by the way. You ready for this? The actor you always laugh at.
I'd have to say Richard E. Grant.
Lovely.
Yeah, I did a film with him once and I spent a month in Romania with him. And I used to go for dinner with him every night and we roar laughing. I mean, he's one of the funniest guys I've ever met. But his performances are equally. Whitney and I is my favourite film. It's just incredible.
Okay, the actress you always laugh at.
The actress? I'd have to say Sharon Horgan is one of my favourites. She's incredible. You know, so there's nothing she's done that isn't hilariously funny.
I would love to have a glass of wine with her.
Yeah, I've never worked. I met her brother before. I met her sister, and this recent project we did is our production company are doing it.
Okay.
For Amazon and Channel 4. So, Frank of Ireland. Yeah. So that's, yeah. I'd love to meet her sometime. But anyway, even if I don't, she's brilliant.
The movie you always laugh out loud at.
Elf. Probably.
Yes. Amazing.
That and Tropic Thunder is the other one. I just adore Tropic Thunder. I think it's, I can never get tired of it.
The comedian you always laugh at.
I love all sorts of different types of comedy, but I'd have to say Dylan Moore just kills me every time. I think he's the finest comic of all time, and to be having him as an Irishman is amazing. I really do think he is outstanding.
That's high praise. And finally, Pat, your best or worst joke?
I tell this every Christmas. My kids hate me for it. And I kind of tell it deliberately. And if anyone mentions it, like a meringue, they all go, oh, he's going to tell the joke.
Go on.
So it's a guy in Belfast walks into a shop and he goes, could you tell me, into a bakery, he says, is that a pavlova or a meringue? And the guy behind the counter says, "Hi, it is a pavlova, you're not wrong."
Amazing!
It's so bad, isn't it?
It's so bad. It's a great dad joke.
Yeah,
because
yeah,
it's
yeah.
So bad. Oh my God, Pat Short, this has just been so fabulous. I can't thank you enough for sharing the last of your life.
It's a pleasure. I've been looking forward to it, Darren. Great to see you and lovely to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to the Laughs of Your Life podcast with Pat Short. What a fabulous guy. Lots more brilliant episodes to come this season, if I say so myself, with 5 more guests to go. So if you haven't liked, subscribed, rated or reviewed, I would really appreciate it if you did that. You can tweet me at Darren Garrahy or DM me on Instagram. I always welcome feedback. This season of the Laughs of Your Life podcast is brought to you by TK Maxx. Everyone can feel fabulous for less, with big wins, small prices, from TK Maxx. This podcast is recorded with Collaborative Studios, and guest booker this season is Olive Esler.